Oh my, everybody up on this roof, that they're all off the roof. I am on the roof of Explosion 4. Got fire through the roof of the fire, knowing the entire rear section.
Now, remember, given the mayday, has he been accounted for? Okay.
610B, that was the mayday. 610B.
I'm here. We got a fire. 1.5-story, single family dwelling. Fire shown from the second floor. Give me a second alarm on this.
Up to the top floor. I got people hanging out the top floor windows with a baby.
Commercial building. A lot of fire, a lot of smoke. Go ahead and strike a third alarm on my orders on this.
I got people on the front fire escape here with windows vented below them. We need somebody up there.
Yeah, let them know we got a job. I'm pulling up now. Second alarm, I got a 1-story single family frame, heavy fire showing from the attic.
So we're using all hands. We got one line stretched, fire on the fourth floor, second line being stretched, primary searches are underway.
Welcome back to the command post. I'm Chief Rick Lasky, along with my good buddy, Chief John Salka, and we got another show for you lined up for this particular episode, another topic. Hoping everybody had a great, safe, and happy Thanksgiving. A lot of challenges out there still with people coming out of or still working through the pandemic and a bunch of different things going on out there. We got the holiday season again kind of coming up hot and heavy. And we've had family over and you had everybody over, did you?
Yes, we did for the first time in a couple of years. We had all five kids and three daughters-in-law and one grandchild and my wife and I. So it was a nice complete family gathering on Thanksgiving morning, which was fun.
And a little bit of snow, which I know you like.
And we had a little bit of snow, too. We had a little coating of snow right around the Thanksgiving holiday there. So I enjoyed that as well. Yep, that was yours.
Very cool. You know, it was great. And, you know this, being a grandfather, you know, all those old codgers always tell you, oh, you think you love your kids. Wait till you have grandkids. Wait till you have grandkids. I'm like, I'm telling you, I'm in love with that baby girl so much. It makes my heart hurt. So we got to spend some great quality time and have a great Thanksgiving. So, hey, you know, we're in Spring, Texas with our friends down here in Spring, Texas, right outside Houston, doing another one of our company officer academies. And we're in a, excuse me, what you would call a high rise hotel that we're staying in. And, you know, it's always kind of funny every time you and I, we tie everything to shop. We sit down at a restaurant. We're looking for sprinklers. We're looking for exits. You know, we get into large warehouses or like a large auditoriums. We're looking for like, all right, where's their standpipe kick? Where's this? Where's that? And we get into hotels, and the first thing we start doing is
talking about smoking the whole way and everything else. So true. So
talking
true.
About smoking. And I talked about Eddie Enright. You know, you've heard me, to our listeners, you've heard us talk about Chief Eddie Enright from Chicago for decades. Eddie, an old Snorkel Squad one guy from Chicago, captain on Engine 98 at 202 East Chicago by the John Hancock Building. Incredible firearm commander. Ended up going from there to the 3rd Battalion, then 221, Deputy District Chief 1 downtown and down in the loop, and a high-rise guru on top of it all. But I tell you, John, I mean, 30 years ago, we would go check in at a hotel, and we'd be walking down the hallway to our rooms, and he'd stop at his doorway. And then he would do like these paces to the stairwell. And so he goes, well, I'm about 2 crawls a stride. He says, so I want to know if I have to come out of here on my hands and knees and make it right, how many crawls is it to the stairwell? And, you know, the doors, the windows, and how many floors we're going to stay on and so on and so forth. And, you know, we got into talking about President Bush Sr., how the Secret Service would only put him like on the 7th floor of most hotels because that's as high as the aerial ladder could, the ladder truck could make it to a window, so on and so forth. And, you know, all these different things. And then tonight, you know, we'll get into a little bit later, but we'll just jump ahead here. So I'm going to my room, you're going to your room, and we're talking about, you know, okay, there's a stairwell, and Eddie, and you go, well, you know, we're on the top floor. And what'd you say? If it's hot and heavy up here.
I would say, like, if you go into a high rise fire, and this will be an office building or a residential, we'll talk more about the difference a little bit. But I said, you know, you go in some residential 9th floor fire, you know, pumping, you know, 9 George or whatever. And when you break out into the hallway from the stairway, the ninth floor hallway is charged to the floor, zero visibility, and it's hot. Not searing hot, but hot. And everybody say, wow, how do you find the apartment there? You got a big long hallway with maybe 20 doors. How are you going to find the apartment there? That's the easiest one in the world. You zoom down the hallway and you bang your hand against every door, and the one with the fire is going to swing open. Why? because that's how the hallway got to be so crummy. How so hot and so smoky, because obviously the door's either wide open and allowing everything to blow out into the hallway, or it's not closed properly and it's allowing everything to come out into the hallway. But either way, you look out the crappy hallway conditions, you should be able to find the involved apartment or the involved room relatively quickly by quickly going down the hallway and pushing each doorway in. At least then you'll find it. Then you can actually grab it and you know, close it or hold it closed a little bit until you mount your operation.
Well, and you'd like to think that all the doors have self-closures on them, but we know that, you know, that.
Well, listen, you'd like to think that. So, number one, it's not true. There are some states and some cities that don't have that requirement, like New York City and New York State, that, you know, pretty forward-thinking, you know, high-rise regulations. But a lot of places don't. That's number one. And number two, some of them wear out. Some of them are undependable. Some people chop their doors open or disconnect them and things like that.
It's an older building.
Absolutely.
You and I were in I guess it would be kind of upstate New York for a conference, and it was an older hotel, if you remember.
Oh, that was scary.
Oh, and we're walking, and there's a door open.
And you look inside, there was all mattresses piled in there and everything.
Mattresses, and then the next room was all open. It was just carts and carts of towels and pillowcases and the dirty laundry. And I'm like, and there's, remember, right on that same hallway.
All wooden doors. And
no closures. And there was a wedding going on. And it was not sprinkled.
And you could hear it down the hallway because the doors were like either chopped open or just left open. You know?
No sprinklers.
Listen, before we get too far along here, what we want to remind our listeners is, you know, when you talk about high rise, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. It doesn't have to be super high rise. It doesn't have to be 30-story buildings or anything like that. Anybody's got a 7 or an 8 or a 9-story building, maybe even a 6-story residential apartment house in your town. Maybe that's the high rise in a place where you fight fires. But we want to make sure we draw a difference, you know, point out the difference between residential high rise and commercial high rise or office building high rise. We are not talking tonight about commercial or high-rise office buildings. We're talking about high-rise residential buildings. And it's not just a matter of, oh, they have different things. They're totally different buildings, the way they're laid out, the square footage, the locking devices on the doors. Obviously, there's different, you know, you go to either a hotel or an apartment house. We have residential furniture. We have bedrooms, bathrooms, kitchens, dining rooms, hallways. And in office buildings, you don't have that. You have desks and all sorts of other, you know, commercial or office type furniture. So we're not talking about commercial. We're not talking about office buildings. We're talking about high-rise residential apartment houses, hotels, et cetera.
Which both of them, like you said, one a little bit more than the other, are loaded with frozen gasoline. You know, all the foam and plastic and all the stuff, whether it's the laminates on the floor and the carpeting and what they have for mattress and tabletops and just, you know, everything nowadays, you know, that we're loaded up with is a BTU producing crazy ass animal when it catches on fire, which you know, is something, you know, a long time ago, back when my old man, you know, was fighting fires, they didn't see as much of, you know, but it's different for us. So let's talk about this. So I think, John, you know, a lot of big cities out there, but to be honest, in our travels, it seems like the average, I'd say, residential high rise, you know, apartment building, tenement, whatever, in a lot of the cities and a lot of the suburbs, you know, they're 4, 5, 6, maybe 6 to 10 stories seems like to be like the norm, doesn't it?
That 6 to 10 is very, very common. You know, obviously you have some big ones, even like in the area that I worked in the Bronx, certainly not a high rise area, but we had more than our share of projects of fireproof multiple dwellings. Some of them as tall as 20 or 30 stories. And conveniently for what we're going to talk about tonight, the rules really don't change much on height other than, obviously, once you get above a certain level, 7, 8 stories, you're probably out of the reach of apparatus, of aerial devices. Outside of that, most of the rest of the options and tactics and stuff that we're going to talk about tonight apply pretty equally across the floor. But smaller cities, a lot of times they get the 1 to 2 to 3 buildings in their downtown area or in the city anywhere that like you said, 8, 9, 10 story, fireproof and residential.
Well, and the other thing with that too is. We've talked about it for years, just like when we did all our shows and we do our training about May Days, that your original rapid intervention team of 2 or 4 people is going to grow to 4 to 6 times that if you have an actual May Day in most cases, just thinking about trying to get somebody to have a single family dwelling, let alone something else. And then you compare that to, you know, for decades and decades, we talk about high rise firefighting. There's a demand for more personnel because of the nature of the beast, because of what we're doing. You know, and it's kind of misleading to the public because they'll see like the street blocks will be loaded with fire engines and ladder trucks, rescues, whatever, so on and so forth, and really think it might be a major, major incident where it might be what a normal house fire would be, knocked with a still alarm.
Could be a couple of rooms, could be a bedroom or a living room and a dining room or something.
We'll talk
like that.
Talk about the difference.
Absolutely. Well, one of the major differences is access, right? Obviously, we get to that address just like we get to any address. We get into the building just like we get into the building. First problem is we have elevators, right? And a lot of people say, oh, we don't use elevators. And if you don't use elevators, I don't know, you just ain't too smart. I can't figure that out. What do you want to wear your people out before they get up there? If you're firing the eighth floor of a 9-story building, you're going to have to use your elevators.
And I remember a major, major metro city in Texas. We were there teaching Save Our Own back in the 90s. And their policy back then was with an automatic fire alarm or report or whatever, they would have to do the stairwell, not the elevators, but in a sneaky way, they would send one firefighter up 2 floors below, get out, and they'd get up a few landings or whatever, and that firefighter would cancel it, going right. Its false activation. But I can't imagine, it's such a labor-intensive operation. You have to get everything you need up in the sky that right. You normally have out on the curb, and to wear your people out, like you said, right. We can do elevators safely as long as we practice old-time practices.
Exactly, and the point is, that's just the first issue of a high-rise residential fire. That's just the first sort of bump in the road that you have to overcome is getting your people up there, right? So whether they have to bring a hose up there, whether they're bringing their tools up there, whether you have search teams going up there, you have to access it, which is either a long hump up the stairs or several people going up in the elevator, maybe taking control of the elevators for fireman service. We could probably do a whole class on fireman service elevators. That's how complex some of those things are, and they're different in every building you go to, every state you go to. They run differently and manage differently. So right off the bat, it's access, elevators. You already mentioned it's staffing. You need a gigantic number of people for staffing. A bedroom fire in a 1 or 2 story home, you could probably bring 8 or 9 or 10 firefighters there. And I'm not here saying that's enough people, but a lot of departments could get away with that. They could send 2 engines with 3 people and a truck with 3 people and a chief and an aide, and maybe adequately handle a bedroom fire in a 2-story wood frame house. Get that same bedroom fire on the 9th floor of a 10-story high rise residential building. You might need 3 times that. You might need 27 to 30 people by the time you start pumping water, using standpipe systems, using 2.5-inch hose, forcing doors, doing search teams, manning the elevators, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly it grows to a much larger operation.
Well, and before we go up, the lobby and we go up. So, you know, and you know what I'm thinking of right away. I'm thinking, you know, I'm staring at the IFSTA high-rise manual and looking at a picture of you standing outside one of your high-rise fires, which whether it was a civilian fatality.
On the cover. That was a residential
high-rise. And a mayday.
Yep. And we had a mayday for a missing firefighter who was luckily found just fine. We had a victim who did survive that fire. That was not a fatal fire.
Okay, wasn't a fatal.
That was a victim that was unconscious in the hallway and picked up and found, located by the first due truck, and removed and survived. And
how many floors building?
Oh, I think that was near 20 stories. If I remember correctly, it was about the 14th or the 15th floor. And all the elevators were out. There was 3 or 4 different elevators there, and all the elevators were out. So every firefighter that fought that fire, whether they made a search or went up with hose, walked up to the top. But before we get too far along, I know what you were going to talk about. Where do you park the rigs? Where do you pull up?
Right.
You know, so there's 2 things to know about that. The first one is you can't figure it out when you get there. That's what training is for. That's what drills are for. Guys say, what are we going to drill out tonight? Let's think of something. Well, drive down to your local or your closest or your furthest high-rise building and see where you're going to put the truck. See where you're going to put the first 2 engine. Is it going to be at the hydrant and pump to the building, or is it going to be at the building and have somebody else pump, you know, so we can get to the standpipe connection? Where are the ladders going to be?
Where are your standpipe connections? Right?
Some places the signage is insufficient or behind bushes. Some places don't have signage, right? I was just in Myrtle Beach, and Myrtle Beach not only has signs, but it has the pressures required on.
Oh, wow. That's a great idea.
Which I thought was pretty interesting. So engines, you know, engines are sort of tied down by what they do, by their other equipment, by the fact that they have to supply water into the building, wherever the building.
And real quick, if we're going to put little, you know, indicators for truss roofs, like we've done ever since Hackensack and a lot of places and so forth, with Varian, especially Myrtle Beach, great fire department down there, by the way, you know, we know those guys and gals, right? You know, actually pretty good idea with different height buildings and what pressures do you need and so on and so forth. You know, not a bad idea. If you're gonna stick a sign that says FTC, whatever, you stick a sign right there that says
a brand new engine chauffeur, a brand new engine officer that day might say, wow, I was trying to figure that out on my way here. We knew it was the 13th floor, you know. So
God, there's so many great ideas.
So now you get your ladder truck. Oh, we got this articulating boom. Oh, we have this towel ladder, 95-foot towel ladder with a basket at the end. Oh, we have this 100-foot straight aerial. Obviously, all these machines, all these tools, all these ladders are a little bit different in size and accessibility to the building. So you have to figure out to some degree where you can be. Some high-rise buildings and shore communities, the whole back of the building's on the ocean. You can't even get to the back of the building.
Right.
A ridge can't even go around the back, just the one side where the parking lot is and maybe the front where the entrance is. So, you know, that's important as well. Don't be taken back by that. If your aerial ladder can't reach the building because the way the building was built, well, that's the way the building was built. You're going to have to deal with that. Right.
Adapt and overcome.
Right.
You know, and it's, you know, you just made me think of something else when the ladder truck that South Blooming Grove, your volunteer department donated to Wichita West, which, by the way, thank you, that rigs. It's a freaking beast. it is awesome. But, you know, it was funny because, you know, somebody else was saying down there, well, what do they need a ladder truck for? They're going to be high rises. And I went, what's that got to do, you know, with the needs or the specific needs for a ladder? I mean, right. It's about reach. It's about the toolbox, about a lot, so much more than that. I mean,
that's one tool on a ladder truck, the aerial device.
Yeah.
Everything else is hand tools. Portable ladders are used at every one and two story, three story house. You use a portable ladder to get to the roof, to get to the second floor windows and all sorts of other stuff. So a ladder truck is a great convenience.
So one of the things, John, I've often pushed and talked about, whether it was low rise or high rise structures or responses to them, when you come in with a lot of apparatus, you know, for the chauffeurs, for the driver engineers, be thinking about where you're going to put your rig, because you see these guys all the time, right? You walk up and the whole street, first of all, there might be cars on the street, residents, people that live there. And what, especially in some of these areas now where they're doing zero setbacks, trying to imitate, you know, New York City and other places like that. But about placement of your rigs, instead of just everybody pulling up and just stacking up down the street, be thinking, this was a big thing. I know it was a big thing in Chicago was, you know what, and Gordon Orr, you see Gordon or Timmy Oakes pictures, just look down the street. You know what? All the rigs are where? They're all off to the state. They all, you know what? As they pull off, they're not going to be doing something. They pull off to the side and they pick a curb.
Like they actually realize that somebody's going to be coming in behind them. It's not a house fire where you're going to pull them with an engine and truck and maybe another engine and truck is going to arrive. Maybe.
Yeah.
This is a high-rise residential building. Even if it's just a couple of rooms going, like we already said, it's probably going to escalate to a higher level. Know that. We just looked at the red lines outside the hotel that we're sitting in right now, and we saw the big, heavy red lines along the parking lot that
for the fire lanes.
The fire lane. So everybody stays out of that fire lane, including fire trucks. We want you to pull up, but we don't want you to stop at the front door and leave, you know, 300 feet of a fire lane in front of you that's not accessible now to the guys coming in or the folks coming in behind you.
So be thinking. Be thinking about, you know what, it's one of those things, John, and not to get away from it, but you and I've talked about the difference between a ladder truck, an engine, and a Quint. And as much as some people talk about Quints this, Quint that, we've always emphasized if the drivers of the Quints have to be, in fact, you can't just put some schmuck on there because you have to be thinking on two fronts.
Right.
You got to be thinking when you set your parking brake, you better be ready to set your jacks and put it in pump. You can't say, hey, Cap.
And reach the standby outlet.
Exactly. Right. I got to shut your line up because I got to pull because there's a tree in the way and I was late in a balcony.
Yeah.
Well, same thing with high rises. If you jam up the whole front, now, first of all, we said it's labor intensive. You're carrying a lot of stuff upstairs or in elevators and then upstairs. Yep. Why would you do that to each other where you make us walk even further or just jam up the streets? And if, let's say you have to get medical down there or whatever, the communication or something, whatever you need, you know, more air, you know, all those different things. Apparatus placement is huge. Mm-hmm. And we all have to just stack it up. Try coming from different directions if you can, but think about where you're going to put the rig. Pull off to the side, park it like you're parking your car, you know, get out of the way and make it more accessible for everybody else. So that's outside.
So now here's another thing you want to think of very early in the outbreak. When you do get there, if you have visible smoke, visible flame, anything coming through the skin of the building, that's a confirmation that you have a working incident. And that's when you're going to have to call for more help, especially a place that doesn't have a heavy assignment. Now, when I say heavy assignment, I mean, some places know that 16 Circle Drive and 17 Ocean Drive, those two addresses are the two high-rise residentials that they have in town.
Right.
And when they get those addresses, they have it worked into the system. They have it worked into the CAD. They get three engines, two trucks, including one from the neighboring town and a rescue from the other neighboring town, and they load it up.
A heavy box,
right? Yeah. Now, some places don't do that. Again, big question mark in my mind why they don't do that, but they don't. So if you don't do that, then it's even more important that the first arriving officer, and that could be the Johnny Young, brand new lieutenant or captain with 6 years, 7 years on the job, he better be ready to call for help. There better be something built into the system for working fire at a high rise. So some code, some signal, some second alarm, or whatever it is.
And just like, and we're going to talk about on day here in Spring, Texas, day three here in Spring, Texas, about this all needs to be predetermined and set ahead of time. So just like you'd pull up at a low-rise residential structure, which your first alarm assignment, which is appropriate for that incident, all right, that task, and bang out an extra alarm, we've got to be thinking big, like you said, big ticket here. You know, be thinking how we are both about thinking big, thinking big. I know Chicago. Smoke on a floor, you know, pretty much a fire, and boom, is automatic 211. In Dallas, the report of smoke on a floor or whatever is a second alarm for them. Talk about some, you know, and there's a ton. We could probably think of several hundred fire departments that do that. If you think about across the country, you know, that have high rises, but there's still some that haven't thought about that when it comes to it, about making sure you have enough people coming. Because we said this, if you don't need them, you can always send them home.
Trying to catch up on a high rise fire, any fire for that matter, but a high rise fire even more so. Trying to catch up just doesn't really work.
Well, and I want to mention one thing that you and I talk about in our travels is I've been talking about this for years and years and years and years and years. We'll go somewhere, you and I, you know where I'm going with this one. We'll go somewhere, they'll pick us up at the airport, we're driving, and I'll look over and go, those are high rises over there. They'll go, yeah, they are. I'm like, okay. Any of them older than you know, built before 1991? Oh, yeah. Okay, so what do you carry for a high rise pack? And nine times 100, well, I tell you, well, 100 feet of inch three quarter with a fog nozzle, like 100 PSI fog. Yeah, fog nozzle. We have a wrench, a couple of things. Okay, so 100 feet of inch three quarter, you know, with a fog, 100 PSI fog nozzle. You know, my next question is, so what are your PRVs set at? And some of them look at you, good guys, but they'll look at you, I go, your pressure reducing valves. Right. Where are those at? Well, they're in the standpipe. And they're in there because what? So we don't blow stuff up, right? Blow pipe. That being said, what are they set at? And they look at you, kind of pause a little bit. I'm like, so what's the significance of 1991 have to do with this? And they look and I go, think about the history of the fire service. One Meridian Plaza, Philadelphia, great fire department, Philly, great fire department, a lot of history, a lot of tradition, but they're a very progressive department, okay? That being said, you know, they were struck with tragedy back in 1991. Three firefighters died at One Meridian Plaza. One of the problems was, and we'll probably get to it, is not knowing what floor we're on, because when it's smoke-filled, you can't read the "you are here" signs, you know, the little ones like we just talked about outside the elevator here. That being said, you know, water pressure, a lot of things that went wrong with that fire, sadly, like they do normally when we have a fatality. But one of the issues was, you know, bringing 100 PSI fog nozzle when your PRVs, now the standard changed in 1993, I believe, 1993 for the PRVs, but 91, they were set to 65 PSI. So we always talk about, you always pump from the tip backwards, right? You pump, you know, master stream at 80, you know, smooth bore 50, fog nozzle. You know, I know there's some 75, but most, you know, your fog nozzle, 100 PSI nozzles. So we always pump from the tip backwards. Well, you're done. You're screwed. You know, 65 PSI, that's
not going to give you 100.
You can put your thumb over the end and you're not going to do nothing. So, you know, valuable lesson learned from the great Philadelphia Fire Department that shared with everyone after that, say, look, don't let this happen. You guys need to, you know, they were the driving force getting a standard change. So knowing your animal first, knowing what you have in your stilter. So you said that, and what you made me think about, you said, well, you may only have two buildings, you know, this one over here, this one over here, that are your high rise. And you may have the extra alarms, the extra staffing and equipment built into it.
Yeah.
Knowing what you have, first of all, in your high rise pack, is huge, and why? And even departments, John, you notice that have a buttload of high rises don't have that many high rise fires.
And that's why your staffing issue is important. That's one of the staffing issue is just not about staffing. Staffing issue really is about hose line operations, because we're really demanding that you use 2.5-inch hose, because 2.5-inch hose has very low friction loss numbers. And if you use smoothbore nozzles, again, it'll operate very safely and effectively, produce a good stream at very low pressures, like 50 PSI. So if you use the big hose and a smoothbore nozzle, FDNY, basic SOPs for high rifle, standpipe operations, regardless of whether you're in residential or commercial, is 2.5-inch hose with smoothbore nozzles. And the reason is pressure, pressure, pressure. It's all about pressure. If you can't produce adequate pressure, if you can't deliver adequate pressure from the standpipe outlet to the nozzle, then you're not going to get a good stream. You're not going to put the fire out. Now, everybody knows that 2.5-inch hose is a hump. It's a hump. It's really heavy. It's really hard to pull. It's really hard to push. It's really hard to move down a hallway. Another reason why you need more people in a high-rise fire, because if you're using the proper, appropriate size, diameter hose line, which is 2.5-inch hose, then you're going to need the extra people just to get that first line moved down a hallway into a living room, past the living room, into a bedroom to put a single room out. So again, these things sort of stack up on each other. It's like a pyramid. One stone is on top of the other. You know, we need the staffing because we need the 2.5-inch hose because the pressure otherwise is going to be inadequate.
Well, and I know, you know, we always try to keep these shows between 30 and 40 minutes long because, you know, people love those. They love listen when they're, you know, on their way to work, to the firehouse, when they're working out or whatever. You know, there's times where, you know, this is one of them. We still have a couple more things, obviously, to discuss. But
right. We'll get a couple more done, but we're not going to do the whole
operation. Yeah, because we can't, you know, there's so much you can cover just in lobby control, you know, and where you're going to set your command post and or your forward
command post. Let me just mention something about that. I don't want to interrupt, but it again, the FDNY, and you hear me talk about the FDNY a lot because it's such a great fire department. And
it's your heritage.
So many people have moved through the job over the years and made things better. You know, and there's great high-rise people from way back when, including Vinnie Dunn and people like Jerry Tracy and others that more modern guys that have talked about high-rises. And, you know, the FDNY for a legitimate high-rise building fire actually special call a lobby control company. They call an engine company. They're specially trained engine companies that go to high-rise fires just to work in the lobby, just to help with the elevators, just to help with managing people in the lobby, getting stuff done and moving equipment up and moving equipment down and talking on the radios and things of that nature. So lobby control is important. Elevator control is important. And again, what does that take? More people.
Well, what a great idea. If you have the ability to do it,
right?
You have the staffing to be able to say, okay, you know, you guys are going to manage this, because that's huge. Who's going up? Who's not going up?
And a small department just might use two people. They might get an engine company and say, I just need two people from the engine to be my lobby control people and release the rest of the company and maybe to go assist with something else.
So we're talking a lot of staffing. We're talking, make sure you bring enough people, you know, think big, especially with the residential high rise. We're talking about where are we going to stick our command post, our incident commander, or it's important, maybe this is where you have that ops chief, where you have somebody that's out drawing all the pictures, doing all the stuff, and you got someone that forward command post kind of running everything, you know, like we've done in other places. And then we've got our lobby control people getting up to that floor. You know, again, we talked about knowing and how to manage your elevators, and we always talk about you go at least two floors below.
Mm-hmm.
When we get there, we're talking about a logistics floor, which is that second floor below
the floor. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's very important to have that. That obviously we have an operations. Obviously we have a command post down in the lobby somewhere. Right. You may be 10 floors away, or you could be 30 floors away from the fire floor. Then somewhere up in the vicinity of the fire area. Let's just put the fire area on the 15th floor, the 18th floor. You know, a couple of floors below the fire floor is going to be your operations post. It's going to be another sort of lobby command post type of an atmosphere. There's going to be chiefs up there. There's even going to be companies sent up there. Companies are going to stage up there several floors below the fire. If you have a staging area, so they don't have to be dispatched from the lobby to take an elevator up to go to work. They'll be masked up there already. The elevators will be working earlier in the fire, and you'll have maybe two engines and two trucks a couple of floors below fire operations, so they can be immediately available if they're needed and dispatch a floor or two up to the fire.
So everything's right there. That's your front lawn. That's your out in the street group of firefighters you have at that low
close to the building, close to the operation, but not in it yet.
Exactly. Yes. Now, you know, obviously what's going to dictate where we put them is smoke. And we may have smoke that pushed down in stairwells and, you know, all that's going to use up air, especially nowadays, that much more. All right. So we've got that. We're having to bring, you know, I've always said this before. We never seem to run out of people at a high rise fire. and we never seem to really run out of water unless there's a catastrophe. We don't seem to run out of tools and hose, but we run out of air. We run out of air. Every single high-rise fire of any magnitude has had air troubles, air replenishment troubles. And you know where I'm going with this? You and I don't push products out there. You know, there's a couple things we talk in class about. Sims You Share. We don't even know the people, but we love the app. It's just a great app. We used to talk about the Bernardi ZX. It's the arrows that were on the hose that help you find your way out. We're not, you know, we love Dingus Fire. Jeff and Nick, you know, Jeff, Brian, Nick Dingus from Dingus Fire, because it's a vendor that truly does help the fire service, and they have great hearts and they're great people. But I do want to mention, and I'm just going to say this, if you're at all curious about the fire system, reach out to me and I'll explain it, or I'll get our friend, Captain Mike Gagliano, retired from Seattle, talk about it. You know, all I've said about this, Mike Dugan has said it, David Rose is like, where was this stuff a long time ago? Because we're always dragging extra bottles. Guys have little wagons, they made everything else. This is a little tiny, 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 bigger than maybe a straw, all right, that you would drink, you know, soda out of, standpipe that runs up along your water standpipe from the first floor, from either the sprinkler room or the FTC room, whatever, where there's either connection or you can pull up an air truck, or most often there's a cascade system in there and it flows and whatever floor, whatever floor you go, it's like you brought your cascade system from the firehouse into the high rise, whatever floor you're on, there's a box you open up. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, however many hoses you want. You fill, boom, you can be filled up in a matter of so many seconds.
That something that can be retrofitted?
Absolutely. And retrofitted. And anyway, there's several places out there. There's actually a ton that have it in place.
Worth looking at.
It is absolutely worth looking at, because you know what? You don't have to carry bottles of it. And everybody always runs out of air. You could bet, you know, it's not a method to make you go through 3 bottles or 4 bottles. What it is when you get inside and you're just making headway and you go, damn, now I got to go down and go a floor below and change my bottle. Now you want to protect the stairwell. You hook up. It's like 80 seconds, whatever. Don't quote me on it. It's pretty quick. Bottle full, you go back in and you finish, and then the rest of the guys come up there. So to our listeners, that's all I'm going to say about it. Is look up FARS. There's all kinds of videos on my Facebook and Twitter account. Look up FARS, F-A-R-S. Incredible. I don't know why we didn't do this a long, 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 long time ago. Get a hold of me if you want some information. It's a great, great thing for high-rise firefighting. So,
all right, so what can we do in the meantime? We get thousands, tens of thousands of high-rise buildings in America. Some have those systems, those new systems, which are emerging. Some don't. Some will in the future. Some will not. Some fire departments, I remember when I was in rescue 3 years ago, many years ago, and I think the rescue companies and squad companies still do it. When they go to a high-rise fire, they switch to one-hour cylinders. Now, there are companies that do that. There are departments that do that, too, that the companies that protect or that respond first do to the high-rise district have a number of one-hour cylinders on their apparatus that they can switch their 45s or their 30s out and go to our cylinders for high-rise fires, which gives them greater capacity, greater number of minutes.
And it's not to wear their people out, because here's the thing nowadays with smoke and cancer awareness, you know, sometimes you get out in the stairwell and the smoke is pushed down. And if you're really supposed to be masked up, you're not even on the fire floor yet, and you're breathing air already. Yeah. So that's a good idea.
So that's one way. You can go with larger cylinders, or if you're in 30s, maybe you can go to 45s for the high-rise fire or something of that nature. And the other thing is to, as Rick already said, was you can mass numbers of bottles at those staging areas or at those operation posts a number of floors below the fire. And that's something that you see all the time on the newsreels when there's a high-rise fire. LA was pretty famous for having, you know, a piece of rope with 2 bottles attached, sort of draped over the SCBA that the guy was wearing. It's actually walking
and
up
you know
with
why?
3 bottles.
Because LA, great firefighters there, they had some horrific high-rise fires.
Yes.
Every single one of them, they ran out of air.
Yes.
So they came up with a great idea.
So certainly you got to get some bottles up there. Something else the FDNY did more recently was they have carts. Some of the Midtown engine companies and the MAST unit, MSU, MAST service unit, they have these carts. So they can put 20 cylinders on a cart, wheel it into an elevator, bring it up to the logistics, you know, up to the floor below or 2 floors below operation post, wheel it out. And suddenly, without a single firefighter carrying a single bottle, we have 20 or 25 or 30 bottles sitting on the floor below or 2 floors below a high-rise fire that firefighters can come down, refill or change their bottles out with the fresh bottles.
But that ain't going to happen if first of all, you don't know what's in your high rise pack and why you have it in there. If you don't know and drill and practice on your high rise SOP, if you don't think big, if you don't think about what your resources and what tasks you're going to need, just thinking that you would go, I have to bring more bottles up. Just if you think about what you have to do up there, you know, and how to get to it.
And another task for more firefighters. Everything we brought up here so far, more firefighters, more firefighters, more firefighters. So again, that's why you have to double, maybe even triple your normal assignment for a high rise.
Well, and let's talk. If we're going to talk about one more thing, you know, or two more things, you know, let's just talk about stretching the line briefly, because, you know, I've asked people before, see, I have 100 feet of inch and 3/4. Well, we know in most residential and most definitely commercial high rises, you're going to lose a length per landing almost, because it doesn't go straight up. It does this whole, you know, snake thing, you know, kind of, you know, up the stairwell. So now you get up there and you have 50 or 75 feet, if you only have 100 feet, to get down the hallway and get into the unit. And a lot, how many times have so many of us been in the living room and the fire's rolling down the hallway and it's coming around and we're like, God, I just can't get it. I just can't finish it. I got to talk about stretching lines. So obviously we want to hit the standpipe, the floor below, advance up our stairwell to get onto our hallway. That's the first question. What do you recommend? We talked 2.5, but what do you recommend for the bundle pack? What, you know, 100, 150? What do you?
Well, if you look at, see, this is going to come back down to codes and it's going to be probably a local thing, but most buildings, most high-rise buildings, most of the codes, and this is just my experience, are about 150 feet of hose, right? And even a long building that has several different stairways, usually there is a standpipe somewhere in the building that's within 150 feet of each apartment door. Now, if you go up the A stairway, you might not be able to reach the apartment on the 9th floor because you should have went up the B stairway.
It's closer
you
know that way. Yeah. Knowing where your fire is.
Familiarity. You got to know where the fire is. You got to know A, B, C. We used to remember that when I was in 48 Engine, a couple of the big high rises we had right on Webster Avenue. Well, like A, B, C, D, E, we use the A stairway. F, G, H, I, J, you know, you remember what numbers and what letters you'd use each stairway for. That's number one. Number two, you can, and I've seen some departments use the fire floor outlet in an enclosed stairway, right? That saves you some hose too, all right? Number three, if you want to figure this out, you got to say to yourself, how do we do this? We go to this place in the middle of the day and drag hose around. And this is one of the greatest things I ever saw in a drill was they use rope. They go get a nice, big, heavy piece of rope, current mantle rope, 150 feet long.
You're out of service rope. Out of service rope.
That's it. And they tie a big piece of black tape on it every 50 feet. And now you can run this rope through the hallway. You can tie one end of the rope to the standpipe outlet, through the doorway, up the stairs, or however you want to run it, down the hallway, to the left, to the right. And you can actually walk through with a pen and a pad and write, you know what? We can get into this apartment, this apartment, this apartment, this apartment, this apartment with 150 feet of hose here. Untie it. Let's go to the other end of the hall. Even people walking by with groceries and with their kids coming home from school. What are you guys doing? I was just measuring how long the hose has to be to fight a fire up here. You know, so you don't have to be up there with gear. You don't have to be up there with hose and with couplings and make it a dangerous condition for people that live in the building.
Do damage.
You just bring a nice piece of rope up there, taped off at 50-foot intervals, and you can very quickly with a small piece of rope, one guy can hold 150 feet of rope in his hand. You can lay it out all the way down different hallways and get all your measurements done on hose, which is a great idea.
Which brings me to my next point was, okay, so you hit that first, you know, standpipe for your first attack line. And I've always asked this, so where do you go for the second one?
Yeah,
you don't go to floor above, where do you go, 2 floors below? And that's why, you know, I thought it was a pretty cool idea, John, was, and we did it for the longest time, was, you know, the lightweight, we did the lightweight 2.5, a 50-footer. Now, some guys will use a 15-foot pony line because they got screwed up standpipes that are like in a corner and you can't get, so you can put that on real quick and drop it onto the floor. But with a 50-foot lightweight section of 2.5 with a gated Y on it, you could take that, connect it to your standpipe, take it and drop it, like you said, on the fire floor, as long as it's protected, you know.
Right.
Or even if it's not, you could have it where it's pre-connected. You could have one line already pre-connected to it.
Right.
Drop the Y. You could go back down and do, you know, like you're supposed to. Come down with your hose, go back up on the outside. You try, right? We're trying to keep our hose big loops on the outside, not where guys are walking. Keep it on the outside of the stairwell if you can. Now, if you need a second line, you get just like that when you do a skid load on the front lot of a house.
The same pumps operate and everything else.
Right there, now you can grab, you can do a second line if due to manpower.
Right. And if the second line's got to open and start operating, and they're going to operate simultaneously using water and shutting and opening and shutting, then the pump operator is just going to have to pay a little bit closer attention to the valves and the gauges and keep everybody's pressure up and listen to the radio and make sure everybody's got what they want. Maybe you're going to get a little burst now and then when somebody else shuts down. Everything, you know, everybody should know to open and close nozzles and standpipe systems nice and slowly so you don't adversely affect if somebody else is on it, even if they weren't attached to a wire, even if they were just off another outlet on another floor. If you slam yours shut, you're going to get a little water hammer and somebody's going to get a little burst of pressure, you know?
So just at the point, 50 footer of lightweight with a Y on it that you can connect to on that fire floor, and then you come up, you can connect a second line, or that 15 foot pony line that you drop away from the standpipe, you could put a Y on it and do the same thing for the most part.
And I can tell you how many times I've used two lines on a high rise fire. I can tell you how many times I've done it. Let's face it, it's a very, very infrequent thing. Almost all high rises are what?
Yeah.
5 foot buildings. So they're almost all 5 foot buildings. Unless it's something dramatic. Like you get a lift, like a plane crash into a building where a couple of whole apartments are burning or something like that, which we've had. But you get the one or two rooms going, almost all the time it's going to get handled by that.
And one more quick thing we need to mention before we're done with this episode is it's an often overthought device that should be in your high-rise pack. And it's something I'm a big believer in. Just for training purposes, when you're flowing water, so you can see what you're flowing, and you need to put it at your nozzle to see really what you're flowing, not what's on your pump panel, but right at the standpipe, we're talking about a flow meter, something you can look at that tells you, right? You know, first of all, if you have to adjust how much is coming out of there for pressure yourself, you know, you have the ability to gate it, but you're looking right at what is coming out of, you know, your standpipe right on that floor. And it's often, I see a lot of high rise packs, John, and I tell you, a lot of them don't have that in there.
Yeah.
They've got extra wrenches. They've got pipe wrenches in case the wheels off and they got to do it. But
the FDNY uses a pressure gauge, right? They have a pressure gauge and it's not even in a standpipe kit. It's attached to the third length of hose. So we use three lengths of 2.5. One length has a pressure gauge attached. And obviously that pressure gauge attaches directly to the outlet on the floor below or on the fire floor. And then we have a middle length, which has nothing attached to it. It's just two couplings, one at each end. And then the third length has the nozzle already attached. There's no selecting nozzle. There's no finding a nozzle. Three firefighters each take one of those rolled ups. One has the nozzle section. One has the middle section. One has the standpipe section. And they only will go one on one place. You can't misconnect them. There's only one way to connect them because one of them has the gauge at one end. So no hose is going to attach to that. It has one end that hose can attach to, the male end, right? And then the middle one has both couplings available. So it's going to attach to the first one. Then the nozzle section has a nozzle already attached to the male. The only coupling it has is a female coupling. So there's only two couplings that have to be made up for standpipe operation in the FDNY. Three lengths of hose, only two couplings have to be made up to complete that three length stretch.
Well, again, I mean, there's so much to cover. No, number one, I think knowing your buildings, knowing your response areas, knowing what are you bringing and what do you have to do ahead of time.
Right.
To get enough help to the scene, to
heavy bring boxes, people,
heavy boxes, you know what? You can line the street with fire engines, like you said before. You better bring enough people to do what you have to do.
Yep.
And I'll say this, you know, I think a lot of people fall asleep at the wheel when it comes to high rises because they don't have that many fires in them. Yet over the years, look how many firefighters have either been burned or have been killed in high, you know, and you sit there and you talk about a handful of where you see these guys got their asses whooped or this happened or whatever.
And, you know, I know a couple of places, a couple of volunteer fire departments that grew tremendously over the years, a little bit of time before, you know, they look back and they had 10, 15, 20 high rise buildings, still a volunteer fire department. And they end up sending during the day, they end up sending the fire inspector, the on-duty fire inspector, to investigate these automatic alarms in these high-rise buildings by himself to go check it out, which is a disaster waiting to happen. If that's what's happening, then you're going to have to logistically change the whole fire department into either a part-paid department or a call department or something else. I don't know what you can do, but so what does that poor guy do, that poor fire inspector do when he gets to a high-rise building and he sees smoke? Right, coming out of the 19th floor, it's going to be too late for anything. So you're right. Paying attention ahead of time, separate from that, of course, paying attention to it ahead of time, knowing your response area, knowing the size of your buildings, knowing the apartment layouts, knowing the apartment designations, all that stuff. Heavy boxes getting called early, knowing how to use elevators and what size hose lines, and basic standpipe operations, and we just hit the surface.
We just barely touched on everything, you know, the high rises.
So we'll have to have another whole
segment. Go get out there and stretch hose in tight spaces and see what it's like in a stairwell or in a hallway to get your hose laid out. You know, that's another one for another time. We can talk about floors and everything else. But again, how we do most of these, we walked in our hotel rooms and said, let's do one on residential high rises. So hopefully, folks, you grabbed a few nuggets out of this one.
Yes.
You know, without us turning it into a 3-hour high-rise class for you. We do a lot of those as well. But that being said, John, if they want to get a hold of you, best email.
ChiefJohnSalta@gmail.com.
And I'm ChiefLasky@gmail.com. We appreciate you for tuning in and listening to another one of our Command Post podcasts right here at FireEngineering.com. You can always catch some great shows here throughout the week, in the evening, at FireEngineering.com, and all the different podcasts with some great people, with some great information. The Hump Day Hangouts on Wednesdays, a ton of information. So we hope to see you soon at one of our programs. We never end any of our shows without one very important message, and that is please keep the men and women in our armed forces in your thoughts and prayers. And remember, never forgetting means just that, never forgetting.